questions about the gender of South African middle distance runner Caster Semenya started just after she won gold in the 800 metres race at the 2009 World Track and Field Championships in Berlin. Semenya has naturally high testosterone levels, and other athletes in that event, including former Australian Olympic athlete Madeleine Pape, believed that that gave her an unfair advantage. 14 years, Semenya has fought for the right to race as a woman in a battle that is controversial and complex. And Track's governing body has just ruled that she can't compete in certain races unless she takes drugs to reduce her natural testosterone. She's appealing that decision, but now Madeleine Pape, among other people, is on her side. Madeleine's working on her PhD on gender and sport at the University of Wisconsin, and she joins us now. Hi there.
Hi, Jesse. Thanks for having me.
So do you remember that first time you lined up against Caster Semenya at the World Champs in 2009? Were there whispers about her and the issue of gender?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I've thought a lot about that time in recent years especially, and what I can remember is that prior to the race, there was talk about Semenya as a favourite for the women's 800 metres, but not whispers or debates about whether or not she should be entitled to run. So that really unfolded in the days following the heats. So as, you know, the heats and the semi-finals and then the final unfolded. And especially, I think, as a result of the IAAF announcing on the evening of the women's 800 metre final that they were going to be conducting investigations into Semenya's biological sex. So I think the whispers were really sort of given the green light and given some fuel by that announcement by the IAAF.
And when you sat in the stands watching her win the world title, I think she was 2 seconds ahead of everyone else. What were your thoughts?
When I look back, I have to admit that I had a pretty simple view of the situation. I was really quick to jump on the bandwagon, so to speak, and join the chorus of voices around me at the time who were accusing her of having an unfair advantage. But that was also my first experience with notions of differences of sexual development. I hadn't really encountered or learned about or heard about intersex variation before. So I really didn't have a framework for making sense of the situation. And I also, I don't think, had many role models around me who were offering a different example of how we might think about this topic.
And after that race, she was taken for gender testing. She's been fighting with the IAAF ever since. Can you give us a bit of background about why is her gender in question and what's the IAAF argument that would prevent her from competing?
Sure. I mean, we can go back a long way. We don't have to go into all the details, but I think one thing that is important to be aware of is that there have been efforts of this kind in place in international sports since, I believe, the late 1950s and rumours about this kind of topic since at least the 1930s. So basically since women started to have a greater presence in international sport, there have been concerns and anxieties around who should be eligible to compete as a woman. So there's a long history, and what we've seen over time, though, is each time governing bodies like the IAAF or the International Olympic Committee have sought to put in place a regime based on whatever they assumed at the time was relevant to women's athletic performance, they've consistently come undone. They've consistently been shown to have problematic scientific basis, but also problematic sort of ethical dimensions as well. So I suppose that's some of the history, but this more recent period of regulation, which focuses on testosterone levels, really followed from that 2009 experience of Caster Semenya. There have been earlier appeals and changes over the last decade in terms of what these rules have looked like, and a lot of pushback. The levels have changed about the amount of testosterone that's been relied on. The events that are subject to these rules have changed. So it's really in flux. This kind of regulation is very much in flux. It's a moving target, and there's a lot of pushback against the IAAF efforts.
You've changed your view of Semenya. You now support her right to race as a woman. So what changed for you?
Yeah, so Jesse, my own athletics career came to a pretty abrupt end in 2010. I had got an Achilles injury. I had some surgeries and wasn't able to run again. And so I moved to the United States to do something else, to do a PhD in sociology. But I moved here without any intention of studying gender or sport. It just so happened that I took some classes that started to discuss these questions, and it was only then that I realized that there was this long history of gender verification efforts in sport. I hadn't been aware until that point that that there was this history. Even in 2009, I wasn't aware of that. And initially, I found the idea that there shouldn't be such rules very confronting. It was difficult for me to start to think differently about the assumptions I held about sex difference and differences between men and women and how we can sort of draw a line. So I definitely didn't change my mind overnight. It was a long process of doing a lot of reading, talking a lot with people, really trying to understand both the scientific and the ethical concerns that many feminist scholars have raised about these kinds of rules. And I would say most importantly, I just became more familiar with the experiences of women who have differences of sexual development, not necessarily athletes, but friends of mine who I learned, if they were athletes, would have been subjected to these rules. And I just sort of came to the realization that I wasn't prepared to deny them the right to compete alongside me.
There's the fairness, or maybe perhaps the ethical aspect of it is I think easier to get on board with the idea that someone through something they can't control finds themselves unable to compete for the gender that they identify with. I mean, that doesn't feel right, does it? But then what's the scientific objection? What's wrong with drawing a line and saying on this side of the line you are actually for athletic purposes a man, not a woman?
Right. So first of all, the World Medical Association has pointed out that women who have the differences of sexual development that are being targeted under this this regulatory regime are certainly not men. They are classified as females. It's important to be aware that by medical definitions, these women are female. But when it comes to, but the I think the crux of the question at the moment is, to what extent can we really rely on naturally occurring testosterone, so not artificially enhanced testosterone, but to what extent can we rely on measures of naturally occurring testosterone as an indicator of how well an athlete, a female athlete, is going to perform? So that actually, even though I had long assumed that there was a straightforward relationship, we've seen over the last few years there's a lot of back and forth between various endocrinologists or hormone researchers in the broader scientific community debating the approach of the IAAF and pushing back against their research and pointing out a lot of the technical and methodological problems with their research, and pointing out that when it comes down to it, athletic performance and biological sex are both really complicated, and it's very difficult. And at this point in time, some people say it's scientifically impossible to clearly show precisely how much testosterone actually affects athletic ability. Now, people are not denying that testosterone has some effect, but the question is it so much more decisive than other factors that contribute to athletic ability that we can actually justify singling it out as the factor that we're going to rely on to say who can and can't compete as a woman?
And while it's unclear and too difficult to determine, do you say err on the side of inclusion?
This actually gets to something I've been grappling with. So initially when I started to learn about this topic, I found comfort in the idea that there was scientific debate and inconclusiveness, and therefore I could say I was opposed to these kinds of regulations. I over time, I started to think, okay, but what happens if the IAAF does generate evidence that I and other people think is satisfactory? Then, you know, what then? Will I then say that these rules are justified and should be put in place? So for me personally, I've decided that I want to recognize women who identify as women and give them the right to compete regardless of their testosterone levels and regardless of what the science has to say about their testosterone levels. But certainly the Court of Arbitration for Sport and the IAAF are very committed, I think, to trying to come up with a scientific approach to deciding who can and can't compete in the female category.
And tell us why, even if the IAAF works out a way to demonstrate conclusively that someone like Caster Semenya has a natural advantage over the woman she's competing against, tell me why you would still have her compete.
There are a few things for me that prompt me to think that way. So, I mean, first of all, when we look at these kinds of rules in historical perspective, and even if we look at the last decade of debate around this topic, it has consistently been the case that the science is unclear, and it is, I don't think that's going to change. Like perhaps, you know, the IAAF, and we've seen this even with the Court of Arbitration for Sport decisions, you know, like 1 year they ruled against the IAAF, a couple of years later they ruled in favour of the IAAF, but I think it's going back and forth because there is still uncertainty. So I would expect that, you know, that's going to continue to be the case because athletic ability and sex are not going to get any less complicated over time. So that's, for me, that's one reason. Some of the other reasons, I guess, relate to ideas of what counts as fairness in women's sport. And I don't think I am entitled to a medal, and I don't think I'm entitled to assume that I can make a final. And sometimes, and we see this in so many sports, it doesn't matter how hard you train or how much you're committed to your dreams of achieving, you know, greatness in sport. Sometimes it doesn't work out, and there are so many factors that go into giving certain people advantages over other people. My own advantages in Australia came from having access to a great sports medicine system and great sports science. I, you know, had the privilege of going also through a great education system, and all of those factors contributed to me bringing my own sources of advantage to international and national competitions. And so I don't think that there is necessarily something unfair about people having these different sources of advantage. You know, in the case of Caster Semenya, she may bring testosterone levels, and they may be shown to have some degree of advantage associated with them. But she also comes from, you know, a rural community in South Africa, and she's a woman of colour in a country where there's a long history of racist institutions. So, you know, she's also bringing her own disadvantages to the table.
And by the way, I'm speaking with Madeline Pape, who is a former Olympic athlete now at the University of Wisconsin, working on her PhD on gender and sport, and we're talking about issues of gender, and Caster Semenya in particular. Stepping back and looking at the bigger picture as a sociologist, Madeline, what's going on here? What are the factors driving so much scrutiny of Caster Semenya?
I mean, I think a lot of it comes down to the precarity of women's sport. I mean, a lot of women's sports, and even in track and field, which at the moment, when you look at it from the outside, it looks like a fairly gender equal sport, because now we have close to equal opportunities at the Olympic level and world championship level. But a lot of these victories for women have been very recently won. And that includes track and field. You know, when I competed in the Beijing Olympics in 2008, that was the first time that women had been given the opportunity to compete in the steeplechase at the Olympic level, even though it had been around as a sport for men since, I believe, 1928, if I'm not mistaken. So we still have to fight for the right to be recognised as legitimate athletes whose performances are worth celebrating in their own right. I think there's that part of like people wanting to do what's right by women's sport, and that's at the moment coming up against a lot of changes really in the ways that we're thinking about gender and the ways that we're thinking about sex and a lot of the sort of traditional categories that we've been used to are being challenged. And for some people, that's really difficult to reconcile with the kinds of commitments they have when it comes to doing what's right by women athletes. So I think that, to be honest, I think that sport and women's sport actually can afford to have more inclusive categories. I don't think that's going to undermine women's sport or be the end of women's sport. I think it can actually strengthen women's sport, but you know, there are people are nervous about what these broader changes are going to mean for women's sport.
You actually testified. You testified for an Indian sprinter, Duti Chand, who was dropped from the 2014 Commonwealth Games because of high testosterone levels. How was that experience, and what was your argument about why she should be able to race?
Yeah, so at that time, I was just starting to sort of come to terms with my own sort of change in opinion on this topic, and I was asked if I could testify to sort of explain that, you know, a lot of people in sport will hold certain views about who counts as a female athlete and who shouldn't count, but you know, sometimes sport is a bit of a silo, and we also need to consider how our views can change when we're surrounded by people with different ideas. So I was testifying to explain that, you know, I could relate to why some women were opposed to the participation of women who have naturally high testosterone, that I can understand it, but that I can also see, you know, how one might come to change their point of view. So at that time, I testified purely on the basis of my personal experience. Since then, I've gone on to do my doctoral research on this topic, and so I would have given, I think, different evidence if it had been now compared to 4 years ago. But at that time, it was my personal experience.
You recently tweeted, "Why is it so hard to keep nuance on the table? Beware efforts to simplify this complex topic. Scientific consensus on testosterone, I think not." So is it, the question I suppose is it possible to write rules with nuance?
I think it's really, so I think that comes down though again to whether we think it's necessary to come up with scientifically based rules for women's sport, and I personally think when it comes to women who have naturally high testosterone, who would be clinically categorized as having a difference of sexual development, I don't see that it's necessary to impose rules of any kind on their participation. Now, some people I think have a very strong reaction to that idea, in part actually because they have fears about women's sport changing forever, not just because of women with high testosterone competing, but also because of the possibility that it might lead to the greater participation of trans women athletes, which I treat as a separate topic because trans women are subject to different regulations and they're a different group of women. But clearly people have these broader anxieties that they're bringing to the issue of women like Caster Semenya. And that certainly needs to have a much more considered and careful conversation and compassionate conversation, the participation of trans women, I mean. But I really think it's important for people to to not bring their feelings about trans women athletes to the topic of women with differences of sexual development, like Caster Semenya, who I think deserve to be judged on their own terms.
Finally, is this debate good for women's sport or bad for it?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think one thing I take inspiration from is the work that a number of women's sports organizations have done around this topic. So in the United States, there's the Women's Sport Foundation, which is a very prominent organization here. And then internationally, there's the International Working Group on Women and Sport, which coincidentally New Zealand is very involved in, and is currently the leadership of that organization is currently based in New Zealand. And those organizations have come down very strongly in saying that they see the participation of women like Caster Semenya as good for women's sport. And they want to see women like Caster celebrated and put on the pedestal that we so often give to successful male athletes. And I think in that way, they see it as good for sport because they don't want to be putting ceilings on what women are capable of, but also they want to embrace a more inclusive definition of who counts as a woman and what a woman can look like and how a woman can express her identity and express her sexuality. I think in that way they're taking a very progressive approach, and that's part of why they see this decision as really important for women and for women's sport.
It's a real privilege to talk to you, Madeline. We've talked about Caster Semenya for most of it, and I should point out to people that you are a tremendously accomplished athlete in your own right, have won the 800 metres time in under 2 minutes, and so to get your perspective on this is really valuable. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Jesse. I appreciate it.